Professor Francis Fukuyama is a renowned and vigorous scholar. As was mentioned, he currently holds an endowed chair at the Institute of Public Policy at George Mason University. Professor Fukuyama was born in Chicago in 1952. After studying classics at Cornell University, he received his PhD in government from Harvard. Professor Fukuyama has been an active member of the political science faculty at the RAND Corporation, where he is a senior social scientist. He has also worked as a deputy director at the U.S. State Department. Professor Fukuyama has never shied away from tackling the big questions of our time, and as the titles of his best-known works indicate, The End of History and The Last Man, and Trust, the Social Virtues and the Creation of Prosperity. He has been a forerunner in the well-known debate about social capital, a debate over the civic and moral foundations of prosperity. He currently is writing a book that explores these ideas, especially in the realm of family and community, entitled The Great Disruption. It is an honor to hear from Francis Fukuyama.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I'm delighted to be back at BYU and back in Provo. I spoke here, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. At the time I was writing my last book, Trust, I came and lectured a bit about some of these concepts of civil society, social capital, and community. When I left Provo, I had an armful of literature about the LDS and about the history of the Mormon Church and about social life in this part of Utah, which I found so utterly fascinating that it eventually got incorporated into about half of a chapter of that book, because it seemed to me that in many ways the history of the Mormon Church is a perfect parable in a way for the history of civil society in the United States. And so if I speak to you today about the crisis of civil society in the U.S., it's a little bit ironic because Provo is about the last city in the United States where you need to lecture people about the need and the weaknesses of contemporary social life in the U.S. Let me begin by talking about the general concept of social capital. It is not, as they say, rocket science to understand what this is, and it's a fairly straightforward way, I think, of understanding the ways in which moral values, which we normally don't think of in economic terms, actually have very important economic and also political consequences. Social capital is simply the ability of people to work together in groups and organizations based on commonly shared norms. What these norms are is not arbitrary. They substantively have to deal with things like honesty, the keeping of commitments, telling the truth, mutual reciprocity, and the like. And in a way, you can see the importance of the substantive character of these norms by looking around the world, because we find very quickly that social capital is not evenly distributed, and there are certain parts of the world in which the norms are not conducive to the building of spontaneous organizations. Now, probably in Provo, there's not too much of a danger of insulting too many people from southern Italy, like there are if I was lecturing in New York City or in other places. Nonetheless, I don't want to make this at all ethnically disparaging, but I think that it is probably true that several generations now of social scientists have seen southern Italy and Sicily in particular as an area of particularly low social capital. In fact, one of the great classics of modern American political science was Edward Banfield's The Moral Basis of a Backward Society, which was a study, an intensive study of a small town in southern Italy. And it's actually quite interesting because Banfield had previously, earlier in the 50s, written a study of St. George, Utah, in which he described an incredible plethora of social organizations in a what was at that time an extremely tiny community. He immediately went to a comparably sized community in southern Italy and discovered that the prevailing moral law went something like this. that you are honest and truthful to people in your immediate family and cooperate with them, your immediate nuclear family, but all others you try to take advantage of, because if you don't take advantage of them, they will take advantage of you first. And he pointed out that this was not conducive either to local government, which ended up being highly corrupt, and as you know, that part of Italy is the home of the mafia and all of the political corruption that has enveloped the Italian political system over the past a couple of generations. And it is also the poorest part of Italy, because there are plenty of, you know, there's plenty of capital, there's plenty of labor. What there aren't is entrepreneurs and people willing to cooperate in the founding of businesses that generate employment and wealth. And I think in general, it is pretty clear that the, you know, this third form of capital, in addition to physical capital and human capital, is quite important both in economic terms and in political terms. In the economy, it is possible to get people to cooperate with one another who do not trust one another and who behave opportunistically towards one another. The only problem is that you need a lot of rules, you need lawyers, you need litigation, you need thick contracts, you need ultimately police and enforcement, because the assumption is that if it's not clearly written down in a contract, you will try to take advantage of legalisms and get around or get the better of your business partners. And all of those costs, the litigation and the lawyers and the legal apparatus and the enforcement apparatus, all amount to what economists call transaction costs. These are costs that could be saved in a society in which people's word was their bond, in which people had commonly shared moral values that allowed them to cooperate much more effectively. I think in the political sphere as well, it's obvious that social capital is absolutely critical to the functioning of a modern democracy. It is really probably Alexis de Tocqueville that stated this the most elegantly. Those of you actually, I'm never sure how many undergraduates have read Democracy in America these days, but those that have generally come away with a single lesson about the United States, which is the art of association. That is to say, Tocqueville, upon traveling to the United States to study the prison system in the 1830s, came away convinced that America was completely different from his native France. Precisely, and he didn't use the word social capital, but it was precisely in terms of social capital, because he said that the U.S. was filled with voluntary associations for purposes trivial and serious, temperance movements, abolitionist societies, Bible studies, and the like. And his argument was that the success of the democratic experiment in the United States was critically dependent on the ability of the citizens of this country to spontaneously organize themselves into these myriad voluntary associations that constituted American civil society. A modern liberal democracy is a system of limited government. It's a system in which the state does not, from the top down, hierarchically organize our social and political lives. And if a system of limited government is to survive, it's obvious that if the society is not to degenerate into anarchy, it has to have a lot of structure that comes from below rather than above. And for this reason, Tocqueville said that the American art of association was intimately linked with the success of democracy in this country. Now, let me go on a tour of the global economy in a certain sense to show the ways in which social capital plays out in the structuring of industries and businesses around the world. I'm going to start in Asia and then move to Europe and then to Latin America and come back to the United States, because I think it's important to understand that social capital, like other forms of capital, cannot be taken for granted. It has to be specifically generated and used and replenished, and not all societies have equal endowments of it. Now, the easiest way to illustrate this is in Asia by contrasting the nature of Japanese and Chinese capitalism. Many of us tend to think of East Asia as one large, undifferentiated cultural area. It's all somehow an area of Asian values, and I think that the whole Asian values argument that was put forth some years ago by former Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore was really not helpful in allowing us to understand the culture of this region, because in fact there are extremely important differences among different Asian societies, and nowhere is this more important or more evident than in the contrast between China and Japan with regard to social capital. If you go to do business in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, or any of the other Chinese parts of the Far East, the first thing that anybody notices is that the scale of individual businesses tends to be very small. In fact, in terms of employees, the average size of a business in Hong Kong has fallen between the 1950s and the 1990s. And the reason that they are small is that they all tend to be individually owned and managed by a single family. And for all of the unhelpful, you know, I think that Lee Kuan Yew in many ways wanted to create an ideology of Asian values to support his form of petty paternalistic authoritarianism. But if you look at the real cultural meaning of Confucianism in present-day Asian societies, it is to raise the family and obligations to the family above any other form of social obligation. To illustrate this, you simply look at an example from a traditional Confucianism. What happens if your father commits a crime and the police knock on your door and say, "Where is your father? Turn him over to us." Now, for any child in any society, this is a tremendous moral dilemma. Do I report my father to the police? And in terms of traditional Confucian values, it is pretty clear that you do not report your father. Your father, your obligations to your family trump your obligations to the state. And as a result, the family becomes an inclusive moral universe. Now, this has a number of business implications. Many Chinese family businesses, for example, keep two sets of books, one for the family and one for the tax collector. And it means that, in a way, you set up a two-tier system of moral values where your primary obligations, your strongest obligations, are to family and kin. And by the way, in China, that's a very large circle of people because it's not simply nuclear families but extended groups like clans and lineages, particularly in southern China. But on the other hand, your moral obligation to the state, the way that you approach civic service, if you're a bureaucrat or a public official, the moral level is considerably lower. And it also has important implications for the structure of Chinese businesses. It is very difficult to create an institutionalized, long-standing Chinese business. There's a so-called Buddenbrooks effect, named after Thomas Mann's famous novel of a three-generation German family. Very few Chinese businesses survive into the second or third generation. They're established by a patriarch, almost always a man, who creates a textile or machine tool business, turns it over to his male children, and by the cultural rules in Confucian societies, the inheritance has to be divided equally among male heirs, which means that it's very hard to accumulate and concentrate capital. By the third generation, the children are all studying art history at Yale or Stanford or some such place. They're not interested in coming back to Taipei or to Hong Kong to run a gritty textile business. And at that point, the family business tends to fall apart. Now, this is not bad from the standpoint of the economy as a whole because there are 10 more family businesses that then bubble up to take its place. But it does mean that it is quite difficult in that kind of a society to generate very large-scale businesses in sectors like autos or semiconductors or aerospace that naturally reward large-scale production. And as a result, in this kind of society, the state usually ends up stepping in to organize large-scale business. We think of Taiwan as a very market-oriented economy, but in fact, in the 1950s, about 30% of its economic output was produced by state-owned factories in petrochemicals, defense, steel, and the like, because that it required the state to organize any kind of large-scale business. The family structure in that part of China was not sufficient to do that. If you go to Japan, the situation is utterly different because social capital is distributed very differently. The Japanese family is more stable than its Western counterpart, but it is a much weaker institution compared to other kinds of obligations. If you are a Japanese young person and you face that same dilemma, your father has committed a crime and the police want to know where he is, you turn your father over to the police. There's no cultural question about that because your obligation, you know, in feudal times, it was your obligation to your feudal lord. Presently, it's your obligation to your company or to the state itself, trumps your obligation to the family. In China, the folklore is all about so-and-so was so virtuous, had so much filial piety that he sacrificed everything for his family. In Japan, the folk stories are all about a samurai or warrior that was so virtuous that he sacrificed his family for the sake of service to the emperor. And it leads to a different kind of business culture. The famous Japanese salaryman is a white-collar middle manager who basically spends his entire adult life spending extremely little time with his family, in contrast to the Chinese businessman that works in the bosom of his family his whole life. Japanese salaryman comes home briefly for dinner, then goes out drinking with his office mates. On weekends, you don't spend time with your family. Again, you go out on an office picnic. And so all of your social obligations, in a sense, go outside of the family. Now, in many respects, the ability of I guess another way of putting this is, in Chinese society, trust, the radius of trust, is limited to family and kinship groups. In Japan, it is much broader. It is much easier for strangers to come to trust one another because the kinds of values that are shared well beyond kinship. And it meant historically that Japanese family businesses had no trouble bringing in a bookkeeper or an accountant, somebody that was prized for professional expertise rather than for bloodlines. And I believe that it is one of the important cultural explanations for why Japanese companies already in the 19th century had grown to be massive, very large industrial enterprises. Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo are all very ancient. You know, they all started as family businesses, but already by the end of the 19th century, they had become very large, professionally managed, hierarchical corporations, very similar to those that exist in the United States or Western Europe. And after 1945, the family owners of these businesses were expropriated under the American occupation, and today they look very similar to any American company. And it meant, similarly, that the Japanese tended to be very good at those parts of the global economy, those sectors of the global economy that dealt with very large-scale manufacturing, autos, semiconductors, and the like. Now, if you go to Europe, I think you find a similar kind of cultural divide between, let's say, Italy on the one hand, which looks very much like China, and Germany on the other, that looks very much like Japan. In fact, in my book, Trust, I have a chapter entitled Italian Confucianism, because in many respects, modern Italy resembles no other part of the world so much as Taiwan or Hong Kong. And this is particularly true in what's called La Terza Italia, the part of Italy that has been the most economically dynamic. You know, Italy has done extraordinarily well in the last generation or two. It surpassed the United Kingdom in terms of per capita GDP, and much of that growth has been from tiny family firms that come from Emilia-Romagna, the Marche, the area in Tuscany around Florence, all of which produce you know, ceramics, designer clothes, industrial robots, you know, designs for the German automotive industry, all produced just as in Taiwan by tiny family-owned and family-managed firms. These famous brand names, Versace, Simint, Benetton, all originated in that part of Italy. And for similar reasons, I think, as in the case of Chinese capitalism, a lot of Italian capitalism has been centered around families because the family is an extremely important social structure. But as in China, there tends to be a deficit of trust outside of the family. It tends to be difficult for strangers to come to cooperative arrangements with one another, and therefore, you know, the few large firms that exist in Italy are in the most northern parts around Milan, and they tend to be non-existent in southern Italy that is much more atomized socially. And again, that's quite a contrast to Germany that has always had an extremely dense civil society. Labor agreements are negotiated between the very large and powerful German labor unions, the employers' federations. There has been, you know, the administering of the apprenticeship program basically out of German civil society. And for comparable reasons, I think German firms have grown to a very large scale, export-oriented firms in the late 19th century in the same way that Japanese firms have. And again, I think that one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons had to do with the prevalence of trust. Now, if you turn to the problems in economic development in other parts of the world, for example, Latin America, I think that social capital provides actually a very useful analytical tool for understanding what some of those problems are. As I mentioned, actually, this is an experience I've had simply giving lectures like this. I've been to Latin America countless times in the last 5 years. I was just in Buenos Aires last week. When I describe the situation of Chinese family businesses and the two sets of books and the two sets of morality, one for the family and one outside the family, it doesn't usually provoke a big reaction in the United States, but every time I mention this in Latin America, usually the entire room bursts into laughter, because in fact, in most Latin American countries, business is organized in a similar familistic way. That is to say, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Mexico, in Peru, 80% of the GDP is produced by companies that are owned by the leading 20 families, 50 families, 80 families. And as in the Chinese parts of the world, you get these very odd business networks where a cement manufacturer and a retailer and an insurance company will all be linked in a kind of nebulous business relationship. To an outsider, it's completely opaque why these companies should be linked to one another, but it turns out if you look beneath the surface, it's all based on kinship, that these networks are all based on family members that have entered into business alliances with one another for the same reasons as in China, that in that kind of society, social capital is very much centered on the family. It is relatively difficult to trust people outside of the family. And I think that many of the pervasive problems in Latin American politics having to do with corruption and in Mexico, the penetration of organized crime into the very upper levels of the administration, again, have cultural roots. There are institutional roots, but there are also important cultural roots. If you have this kind of two-layered morality, as the Brazilians say, there's one morality for the family and another morality for the street, it means that the level of public obligation with which you pursue civil service, for example, as a bureaucrat, as an elected official, if you're elected to the Brazilian Senate, is at a distinctly lower plane than your obligations to the family, so that in some sense you see public service as an opportunity to steal on behalf of your family. And I think that before the onset of this global economic crisis that we are now facing, probably the single most important internally generated obstacle to development for a middle-level developing country like Mexico or Brazil really was the pervasiveness of corruption within its state system and its inability to enforce uniformly and fairly a rule of law. Now, let me conclude just by talking briefly about the United States. I'm going to come back to the U.S. at the end of my lecture because I think we are all primarily concerned with social developments here, and simply to raise the question, you know, where does the United States stand in the spectrum of low-trust and high-trust countries? For example, if you put Japan over at one end of the spectrum as a very high-trust society, very group-oriented, people work together very readily, strangers work together in groups, and on the other hand, you put a society like China or possibly southern Italy at the other side where people are extremely individualistic and go it alone. Where does the United States stand on this spectrum? Now, many Americans actually would put us over at the atomized individualistic end. Obviously, individualism is a major cultural theme that is supported by the nature of our political system, the system of individual rights on which the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are based. And certainly the theme of rugged individualism was absolutely critical in the forming of American self-concept about themselves. You know, Ross Perot, in the days when he used to be admired as a potential political leader, had the motto, "Eagles don't flock, you have to find them one at a time." And in a certain sense, this whole idea of, taking off the IBM suit and starting up your own company in opposition to the authority of this big bureaucratic machine appealed very much to Americans. They would say, "We do not believe in authority. We like to go at our own." But in fact, I think that the truth of the United States, at least up until the 1950s or 60s, was very much the opposite, that in fact Tocqueville was right, that we belong not at the individualistic end, but in a way much more towards the Japanese end, that we always had a very cohesive society, not on the level of a centralized state that organized people, but rather in terms of the spontaneous organization of Americans in groups and organizations. Max Weber, the German sociologist who visited the World's Fair in St. Louis at the end of the 19th century, traveled through the United States, and he said that you would think that Americans would be like grains of sand with every grain of sand representing an individual, but in fact it's an extremely lumpy, you know, cloddy society. Those grains of sand hold together in ways that are extremely unexpected. Now, I will get back to what's happened to that American Art of Association, because I think it's something that's troubling and needs further investigation. But let me move on to one further topic about the future of social capital in a high-tech environment. And in a way, this is also an appropriate topic to bring up in the city of Provo with Novell and WordPerfect and other high-tech software industries located here. In many respects, a lot of social scientists for a long time believed that, in some sense, moral values would go away with the progress, with economic progress. And in many ways, you can see this being said now about the Asian crisis, that one of the criticisms of Asian economic performance has been that everything is very personalistic, that business deals are struck with family members or with cronies or with various associates, and not on the basis of impersonal market relationships. And indeed, you know, there's a great deal of substance to this. The way that social capital is organized in China and Japan does, in fact, explain a lot of the misallocation of capital and some of the underlying structural reasons for the crash in Asia over the past year. But nonetheless, this idea that a modern society and a modern economy could be bereft of trust and moral relationship between people, that it's simply based on impersonal contract and law and lawyers and litigation, I think is not correct. And I think that you can see this most clearly in the shifts that have been occurring, particularly in the management of high-tech, high-skill firms in the United States over the last 15 to 20 years. We have, in effect, moved from an extremely low-trust form of manufacturing and industrial organization to a rather high-trust one, in which the secret missing ingredient that guides you through that transition is really social capital. The typical firm of the early 20th century was something like Henry Ford's Highland Park automobile manufacturing plant or the River Rouge plant in Michigan. These were organized according to the principles of the industrial engineer Frederick Winslow Taylor, and you know, the simplest way to describe them was that they were utterly low-trust organizations. They were hierarchically organized. All of the intelligence and managerial talent was segregated in a white-collar force at the top of the managerial pyramid. The low-skill blue-collar workers at the bottom of that pyramid were controlled entirely by a system of rules and regulations internal to the company that dictated when they could take coffee breaks, when they could get up to go to the bathroom, how many, you know, rivets per hour they had to assemble as the cars went through on the assembly line. It required absolutely no trust whatsoever between workers and managers. And in fact, it was probably appropriate to the American workforce in Detroit in the first two or three decades of the 20th century. Ford's workforce, its hourly workforce in that period, 50% of the workers could not speak English because they were first-generation immigrants. And as late as the 1950s, about 80% of the hourly workforce in Detroit did not have a high school education. So that in many respects, this hierarchical, centralized, bureaucratic way of organizing workers was appropriate to the skill level of American society at the time. What we've done in the last generation is to move from that model to what I would simply call a high-trust model of either flat or networked organizations, in which managers now push as much authority as possible down to the bottom levels of the factory. And in terms of simple information processing, and it's facilitated by the information technology revolution, what it does is it gives decision-making authority to people that actually have the information to act on. If you're in an auto plant and you get a defective door from a subcontractor, it's the blue-collar guy that's trying to bolt it to the chassis that will know that, and not a vice president sitting in a glass tower somewhere in downtown Detroit. And in many ways, the shift to just-in-time or lean manufacturing is a perfect illustration of what it means to move from a low-trust to a high-trust workplace. A just-in-time factory, which not accidentally began with Toyota in Japan and has now spread throughout the American automobile industry, in essence, shifts authority down to the lowest level of the factory. If any of you have seen these Saturn commercials that they used to run a couple of years ago, all Saturn workers have this cord, which is similar to the cord in the Toyota plant. And if they pull the cord, you know, they see a problem in the production process, and they pull the cord, and the entire production line stops. The managers then come out and try to fix the problem at the source. And this ultimately was the ultimate source of the quality advantage that Japanese automobiles used to have over ones produced in Detroit, because if you fix these problems at the source, you build the quality in rather than having to fix it later on. Now, if you think about this in moral terms, what the managers in this factory have done is to turn over, in essence, the ability to sabotage the entire output of the plant to every single one of their blue-collar workers. Any worker can pull that cord and stop the entire output of the plant. You think about locating a plant like this in southern Italy or even in a traditional area, in Michigan, where you have poisonous labor management relations, and you can see that you are inviting disaster. And in fact, this very long Detroit, the strike against GM that occurred earlier this year and a previous one that began in Youngstown a couple of years ago showed the vulnerabilities of just-in-time production to the lack of moral trust and moral connectedness between workers and managers. If you feel that the management is not being open with you in terms of its relations with the UAW, and GM has had plenty of problems like this, the entire output for all of GM's operations then shut down because everything is connected to everything else. You create this incredible vulnerability, and I think one of the big advantages that Ford and Chrysler have had over GM is that they understood the social capital aspect of modern manufacturing. Unless you create those relationships of trust within the workplace, it is impossible to manage these fast feedback loops in terms of information within the factory. Final example simply comes out of Silicon Valley. Most of us associate the American information technology, IT industry, with a high degree of competitiveness, individualism, entrepreneurship, all of these classical American values of people defying authority, going on to set up their own high-tech firms and the like. And that's, you know, obviously the case. If you have it on your resume, you're a software engineer, and you have it on your resume that you've been at the same company more than 2 or 3 years, people begin to look at you like there's something wrong with you because everybody moves on. There's no corporate loyalty or the like. Now, this has led many, I think, observers superficially to conclude that this is, in a way, an example of the success of individualism and extreme competitiveness and social, isolation, and that's produced the boom in IT in the United States in the 1990s. But I think that any closer look at the real nature of social relations in Silicon Valley, in fact, shows something of the opposite, that in fact the success of high-tech R&D in the Valley, and I suspect, you know, you might find a similar story like that here in Provo, has to do with the presence of numerous overlapping social networks that existed among all of the engineers and managers and venture capitalists that constitute the IT industry in that part of California. There's a wonderful book written by a woman named Annalise Saxenian called Regional Advantage, in which she looks at the relative success of Silicon Valley as opposed to Boston's Route 128, in the 1980s and 1990s, and her conclusion actually, she doesn't use the term social capital, but it is really a story about social capital. That is to say, there is a certain culture in California by which engineers would, as economists say, they would informally exchange property rights. What this means is they go to the wagon wheel bar in Mountain View, they're working for competing companies, and one of them, but they've managed to, you know, they both went to their graduates in electrical engineering from Berkeley or Stanford, they're old friends, they meet at the wagon wheel bar and they say, well, how did your company solve this problem? And in fact, they freely transferred extremely valuable pieces of intellectual property, even to cutthroat competitors. And the result was that in the end, because there is a system of moral reciprocity in this matter of exchange, you were able to achieve economies of scale in the sharing of information that could not be matched by any of the large Japanese electronics manufacturers that set up much more rigid and hierarchical forms of corporate control. And if you think about what's happening to our broader society, I think it's almost inevitable that we are going to move increasingly to this form of high trust management, in which authority is delegated to the workers themselves, who have to control their own behavior not on the basis of formal written bureaucratic rules, but in terms of internal standards of professional behavior. You think of what it's like to work in a software company, where every, in essence, every worker bee has a PhD or the equivalent of a PhD, and probably knows a great deal more about the quality of his or her output than the manager who formally, in formal terms, is sitting above them in the hierarchy. It's clear that, you know, when you're managing a room full of engineers or PhDs or whatever, you simply cannot use low-trust Taylorite methods. You have to let these people be self-organizing, self-managing, and that, in fact, seems to be the world into which we are moving, in which informal norms and values that bind people together, that allow them to enter into situations of mutual reciprocity, become more important than they were under the old model of industrial production. Now, let me conclude by talking about returning to the United States and its society as a whole, and what we might expect in terms of the development of our civil society. I mentioned that traditionally the United States has been one of high trust, in which social groups and voluntary organizations played an extremely important role. And I think that most people would agree that, you know, this was in fact the character of American society, at least up through the 1950s. But that in many respects, an important change has taken place in the United States since sometime in the 1960s, extending to the present. The person who has addressed this, directly is Bob Putnam, or Robert Putnam, the political scientist at Harvard, who, in an article that came out about 3 years ago, Bowling Alone, which many of you may be familiar with, argued, you know, among other things, that Americans are bowling in ever greater numbers, but they're bowling as individuals, not in leagues, not in larger social groups and the like. And he catalogs the decline of many American organizations, what he calls the animal societies, the Moose and Elks and Kiwanis and so forth, the junior JCs and the Red Cross and PTAs and the like, and adduces this to argue that American civil society and the American art of association are in a terminal decline. And he also points to survey data. The General Social Survey, for example, has been asking Americans how much they trust various institutions, the presidency, the Congress, the courts, and so forth, since the 1950s. And all of these have shown extremely dramatic declines. The people in the 1950s willing to say that they generally trusted the government to do the right thing was about 70% of those polled. And today, the figure dropped as low as 15% in the early 90s. It's back up to about 20 to 25% now. And in terms of the trust that Americans have for each other, expressions of cynicism have grown similarly. In the 1950s, about 65% of Americans would say that their fellow Americans could be considered to be generally trustworthy. Today, again, that figure is down to around 25%. What is going on? Now, there is a lively debate that has been going on over this Putnam hypothesis. And in fact, the story, I think, is a good deal more complicated than the one that was originally presented by him. For example, Everett Ladd of the Roper Center, who teaches also at the University of Connecticut, has published a lot of data that seemingly contradicts Putnam. It turns out that, for example, PTAs have been declining in the United States because many parents have been abandoning PTA, parent-teacher associations, for parent-teacher organizations, and that Putnam had simply failed to collect data on the growth of PTOs. Similarly, there's, I think, naturally a whole group of new kinds of organizations that have sprung up that are much more informal, that no statistical, you know, counting agency would ever take notice of. All the, for example, AIDS support societies, all of the self-help groups and therapeutic kinds of groups and associations in which Americans have indulged. And in fact, you get this very confusing picture of what's been going on in American civil society over the past few years, that I think, in the end, the bulk of the data actually shows that in terms of groups and group memberships, the trend line has actually, contrary to Putnam, been going up, that there are more groups and people seem to be involved in many ways at rates that are comparable to earlier periods in our history. But there is absolutely no misunderstanding about the fact that rates of cynicism and distrust in survey data have been going down. The question is, how do you reconcile these? In my view, the problem that we have in the United States can be described by a single phrase, moral miniaturization. And I think that this is the key to understanding what's happened to our civil society. That is to say, we are participating in groups as a society, but they all tend to be smaller ones, ones in which, you know, I mentioned the radius of trust as being extremely important in defining social capital. Do you only trust members of your family, or does your radius of trust extend out to larger parts of the society? And in fact, I think what has been happening in this process of moral miniaturization is that the American radius of trust has been declining. That is to say, we participate in our health groups, our internet chat rooms and Usenet groups and this sort of thing, but the groups of people with whom we deal are ever smaller, and the large institutions that used to bind the country together, the government, the military, labor unions, mainline churches and the like, all have gone into a very serious decline. And so that in a way, while we are participating with each other actively, we are not talking to one another beyond the boundaries of those relatively narrow groups in which we, with which we deal. And this, I think, ultimately is a very big problem for the United States, because a democracy needs to be more than a kind of shared passage of individuals or individual neighborhoods or individual families. Civic virtue needs to be founded on a much broader, not only political, but I think cultural consensus about fundamental values in the society. And I think that many of the increases in expressed cynicism have come from the fact that we see the results of moral fracturing all around us, in increased crime rates, for example, that also increased over exactly the same period that Putnam noticed this decline in expressed trust, and in the breakdown of the nuclear family, which again also corresponded to this long period beginning in the 1960s when people suddenly began to be much more cynical about one another. And it stands to reason that if you live in a neighborhood that's victimized by crime, if you live in a family where the chief authority figure has walked off and started another family, that your attitudes and your trust towards other Americans, towards institutions, should be correspondingly lower. Now, in the end, I think that there is a happy end to the story, because many of these social indicators are, in fact, turning around. Levels of trust have come up sharply in the 1990s. And I think in a broader cultural perspective, you actually have long cycles in moral decay and moral regeneration. This is actually the subject for the next book, so I'm not going to get into this at great length, but in a way, the history, the early history of the Mormon Church was a good example of moral regeneration in a period of similar social and moral disruption. The 1820s and 1830s in the United States were times of extraordinary economic change, very high rates of family disruption, especially high rates of alcohol abuse, and lots of indicators that the society, you know, the social structures of colonial America were coming apart at the seams. And that American society in the 19th century proved itself perfectly capable of the kind of moral regeneration that then pushed these rates of crime and deviance to extremely low levels by the end of the century. This is important for us, I think, because we do not want to live in a society that is atomized, in which people do not trust each other, and in which a Tocqueville of the 21st century would say, as he said of France on the eve of the French Revolution, that there were not 10 Americans that could come together for a common purpose. I will leave you with that. Thank you very, very much.